would like to welcome Dr. Trevor Suslow, who is an extension research specialist at the University of California, Davis, with the Department of Plant Sciences. Trevor has statewide responsibilities in post-harvest quality and safety of perishable fresh and fresh-caught horticultural foods. His program emphasizes the role of the environment and crop production practices on post-harvest attributes of edible horticultural crops. And for the past 16 years, Trevor has combined lab and on-farm research related primarily focusing on E. coli and Salmonella in both conventional and organic production systems. Trevor is a member of the Center for Produce Safety Advisory Board and Technical Advisory Board, and also leads the University of California GAPS Outreach Program. So with that, Trevor, today Trevor is going to give us an overview of fresh produce supply chain food safety management. And with that, Trevor, please welcome and thank you for joining us today.
Okay, thank you, Ramiro, and good afternoon to everyone. Just want to make sure that everyone's aware I designed this presentation, you know, really as an entry-level overview of produce food safety-related issues and moving from general guidance to a regulated community as the proposed FDA produce safety rule comes out. I'll touch on each of those, and that will hopefully give you a good background for the second speaker that will talk a bit more depth about the economic impact of the different programs as well as outbreak and illness. And again, I see that some of our participants are very knowledgeable about these sort of general aspects, and maybe with your specific questions, you know, it can deal with some of the more specific uncertainties or technical components. And so really, you know, what has been true from the beginning of recognizing the role of predominantly microbial issues and hazards associated with production of our edible horticultural products, that food safety really has to function across the entire farm-to-fork continuum or the farm-to-fork supply chain, and at each component as depicted sort of pictorial in this slide, you know, from, in this case, strawberry production in an open field environment, all of the inputs that go in there, the adjacent land use, wildlife influences, which we'll come back to, through harvesting, you know, post-harvest handling, transportation and distribution, and finally either food service or retail marketing and consumption by the end user. You know, there are unfortunately opportunities for contamination, but then likewise there are opportunities for preventive controls and interventions along the entire continuum. So just to establish for those that aren't perhaps as aware as those that have been, you know, thrust into this arena, you know, why the concern for food safety of edible horticultural products, I'm going to cover a bit of an overview of foodborne illness in the U.S. Clearly there's international incidents, some of very tragic proportions. There just isn't time to cover all of the details in each of these aspects. Then a bit of an introduction to good agricultural practices and the associated produce outbreaks as sort of a background for then the further discussion of the economic impact and responses. A very brief introduction to what is going on currently in the FDA Produce Safety Rule, Food Safety Modernization Act, regulations that are coming out for public comment. Some of the key on-farm challenges that the industry, you know, has identified, research is trying to close the knowledge gap in how to deal with those contamination events. And then, very briefly, just one example from our on-farm research effort to sort of highlight, you know, what we're worried about, how we're approaching it, and how that may likely influence some of the standards and policies that are being established both within industry as well as from a public health agency standpoint. So very, again, briefly, just to set the stage, the Center for Disease Control, you know, estimates this foodborne illness to be close to 9.5 million cases per year. That's not just for fresh produce. That covers all foodborne illness events, and tragically, you know, as perhaps as many as 1,200 deaths per year, which translates to about 1 in 6 individuals in the U.S. becoming ill every year. Most of these cases are fairly mild. They clear in a short period of time, but as I'm sure you're all aware, some are extremely severe with follow-on consequences for chronic long-term health impacts, and of course, potentially death can result. The sort of key, taking a step back, food safety challenges are broader than just the microbial ones that we will highlight through the rest of this presentation. They include chemical, physical hazards, and of course then the biological, which can be further separated into microbial, various allergens and various toxins that would be elaborated due to the growth of microorganisms, or they might be actually part of the some chemical compound produced by the plant. The category of mycotoxins, or toxins produced by fungi that colonize plant material, kind of fit into the chemical hazard area as opposed to the biological. The organism doesn't need to be present. Not commonly associated with fresh produce, but there is that potential. Chemical hazards, just again to provide a bit of the overview, includes a variety of things that are involved in crop production inputs or post-harvest management. They may be associated with the equipment, fertilization, of course, pest management. Various foods, you know, may have allergens if it's part of a more processed or prepared food. And then just, again, listing the types of mycotoxins for those that might be familiar in other types of foods, particularly some of the grains. Aflatoxin, peanuts would be another. Ochratoxin can be present in a variety of things. And patulin is one that would be more associated with something like apple juices or ciders. Again, just trying to give a bit of a background. Most of these toxins are produced by fungi such as Aspergillus, Penicillium, and Fusarium. And a lot of these toxins, they can have acute impacts, including in animal feed, but in general, they tend to be more of a long-term chronic concern due to their cancer potential. Physical hazards we deal with in the produce area primarily as a consequence of things that are in the field that may either be in the adjacent land or within the crop production environment that include the things that are easy to imagine, you know, glass, wood shards, either from, you know, say a pallet or a bin, or it may come from the non-crop plants in the general area, of course, stones and plastics and metal, and unfortunately, occasionally, you know, animals, whole or animal parts, may or may not be a physical hazard in terms of ingestion, but certainly an aversion factor if they're found in the product. And therefore, you know, I'm sort of briskly moving through these components to get to the microbial concerns, but this is all part of an overall food safety management program. Prevention of physical hazards and mitigation can include, you know, prior crop history, and the image in the left is simply meant to illustrate the potential for prior crop residue that is very woody and hard and doesn't decay or break down within the season can be picked up during harvest and enter into the particularly a bag salad type packaging. There may be things left over from other prior crop rotations that could be banding or strapping or various types of items. And this is primarily a larger concern in any type of mechanized harvesting as depicted here, where a large unit is moving down a solid planted bed. A little bit hard to inspect and visualize some of the potential physical hazards that might be present. They do put people out in front of these machines now to walk and try and minimize that potential, but you can imagine as they're harvesting, these might be picked up and incorporated into the bulk product that's harvested, and then there's various ways that this is dealt with at the product handling and processing end, whether it's passing through a metal detection, various laser and X-ray detection and elimination systems, and some of the, you know, more modern chlorophyll-based defect removal where either a non-product plant material or a plant material that has a lesion or some type of defect would be quickly removed by an air jet. I see that some of the formatting, you know, clips off a little bit of the content here, but I think it's still readable and understandable, so I do apologize for that. Just sort of an interesting thing for those that aren't aware, things like metallic fibers incorporated into bandages or finger bobs or other types of covering are used to readily detect them as they pass through metal detection equipment. It has that sensitivity, and that helps prevent a consumer from finding this in their purchases. So then moving on to the area of a bit broader concern, the microbial pathogens, it's estimated that there are about 250 foodborne pathogens. A very smaller, much smaller subset of those are the ones that are predominantly encountered by public health agencies and involved in clinical cases. Bacteria are certainly the most widely encountered and recognized, but of course it includes viruses and various parasites, norovirus, or the virus that you might be familiar with, sort of the cruise ship type of illness, is thought to be responsible for many more cases of gastrointestinal illness than previously recognized, and currently a very substantial focus has been placed on that. So if we look at the various reported outbreaks linked to FDA-regulated foods, by agent, you can see that over about 70% are attributed to bacterial pathogens during this time period. This is sort of the most updated overview that was available from FDA. And if you look at food item, the reason meat is not on here, it's not part of FDA-regulated foods. But produce accounts for about 20% or so if you add in sprouts as a subcategory of overall produce. In terms of the number of cases as opposed to the percent of outbreaks, produce starts to take on a much greater significance in being closer to 40-something percent of the individuals impacted that actually go in and become part of the reported case history for any given outbreak. So it's been recognized over time, certainly since the early 90s, as an increasing contribution to the foodborne illness in the United States and globally. And if you look then a little bit further at the types of commodities associated with these outbreaks, it's a pretty extensive list. This includes both domestic and imported produce items. And pretty easy to see as you scan down that things such as leafy greens and lettuces, fresh tomatoes and melons, particularly cantaloupes, contribute, you know, close to 60% of the total number of outbreaks that have been recognized during this time frame. More recently, there are other tree nuts that have been included in causing outbreaks or significant recalls due to detection of these pathogens on product. And of course, as I already mentioned, sprouts is sort of a category unto itself, and unfortunately has a fairly high frequency of outbreak and large scale illness quite often associated with their production. So all of this, again, going back sort of to the mid-90s, resulted in the development of this concept of good agricultural practices, recognizing that there is no absolute control point, no absolute kill step that is possible for those types of foods consumed raw or without a cooking step. And they really focused on prevention and redundant reductions or ways to minimize the risk as opposed to in the absence of recognizing a step to truly eliminate it. At the time, this has not been regulation. It was guidelines only. But it kind of became the de facto minimal standard, and industry then embraced that and enhanced it and, you know, got more specific and quite often well ahead of where science could really substantiate the approaches and the standards that were being imposed. But, you know, the buyers became basically the enforcement branch, and that evolved into more commodity-specific and even region-specific guidance documents. And this is sort of just a representation of the diversity of programs that have been put together to try and refine the general guidance, of which there's a lot of commonality. This would be, you know, sort of bringing us into the mid-2000s, late 2000s, and a variety of commodity groups and associations put together guidance with various audit protocols associated with it. So coming up more or less to date then, this Food Safety Modernization Act was signed into law back in January 2011, and it really put the charge to FDA to move from responding to contamination events and following, tracking, and investigating outbreaks and illness to emphasizing preventing it, and really to take the available best science to establish minimum standards for the safe production and the safe harvesting and post-harvest practices for fruits and vegetables that made sense, that really worked towards minimizing the risk. So the challenge then is to really focus on prevention and preventive controls across the entire food supply chain and, of course, all foods. Here today we're focused really on fresh produce. And it's going to be expected that there would be a written preventive control plan that includes the various steps listed, a hazard evaluation, the various steps or controls to minimize or prevent specific hazards associated with a site, with a practice, within an operation, to then monitor and verify that these preventive controls are functional, and where they're non-functional or become non-compliant, to specify appropriate corrective actions and verify that those corrective actions have been effective. So sort of the cycle of management that FDA has as far as its expectation is to really work within this preventive control strategy, and if there is a failure to identify that hazard, to sort of, I guess, devote some level of effort at understanding or identifying the root cause, and I'll be honest in saying that even with the outbreak investigations or the internal assessments that have been done, determining a root cause is not always straightforward or possible. But to implement corrective actions, to monitor the effectiveness of those controls, and then review and adjust your program and incorporate that into the body of your business plan. So, you know, we often talk about, you know, a very well-established concept in risk management, which is sort of hurdle technologies, and this food safety really depends on preventive programs with multiple hurdles that start at pre-harvest and really pre-planting and carry forward all the way through post-harvest, that deal with barriers to arrival of contamination, the effects of acute survival post-contamination, minimizing the chance for persistence or growth, at least of the bacterial pathogens, you know, clearly viral pathogens and parasites that require an animal host for growth are not going to multiply on plants. But pretty much every plant species that I'm aware that's been tested, if you apply something like salmonella, like E. coli, Listeria, and there's appropriate environmental conditions, they will multiply. There's the sufficient nutrients around. Then, of course, any steps in disinfection or removal, and then barriers to regrowth or persistence or growth in the distribution and transportation. So all of these good agricultural practice documents, the FDA produce safety rule, any type of harmonized good agricultural practice and good handling practice programs have some key areas that are felt to be appropriate for all scales of farming and shipping, so large global to limited resource, and these are primarily the focus that, that industry has taken and certainly that FDA is putting a lot of emphasis on. And these are various uses of water pre-harvest or through post-harvest, the involvement of workers and their potential for contamination sort of hand to product, and so therefore their personal hygiene, emphasis on training, and appropriate facilities and management of those facilities is seen as a key area. The potential for contamination due to the application of manures or incompletely composted animal-based manures or even green waste, and the process controls and application and various diverse applications of soil inputs and fertility management inputs that have a potential for carrying fecal contamination in. And of course, associated with that is a very challenging area of wildlife impacts on crop production and contamination, whether it's intrusion into the field or actual fecal deposits, either in water or in the crop area itself or on equipment. So again, there's a lot of different components, not really time to be able to go through all of these in detail. Associated with all of this, of course, is record keeping and documentation of what's being done, of that preventive control plan, as well as the specific daily operational management of that, and an ability to trace product at a minimum, one step back, one step forward for all inputs, as well as the distribution and marketing of that product. So, you know, sort of summarizing, you know, where things stand today very succinctly, you know, I think there's going to be increasing expectations from FDA and consumer groups for the full supply chain in produce to demonstrate and document the effectiveness of this preventive control strategy and any corrective actions that are designed to fit into it. And it's really reasonable to assume that the greatest pressure is going to be on the supply side or the sort of production side of produce, both from buyers as well as regulators and public health agencies. And at least I would share with you all that it's my experience and my belief that aside from a relatively elite group of the industry, most producers, if you talk about numbers and talk about the United States and all the different commodities, really are ill-prepared and lack the necessary scientific literacy to develop these preventive control systems and food safety management plans without significant support. That doesn't mean they're not capable. It just means you can't just throw them out there and expect them to come up with a plan that would satisfy the expectations. One thing that is sort of within the FDA experience base is that relatively small farms, you know, can be responsible for very large multi-state outbreaks. The particular example I'm sharing with you here is the Salmonella St. Paul outbreak back in 2008 that caused, you know, over 1,000 cases of recognized illness because of the complication of traceback and traceability that was associated, first thought to be associated with fresh tomatoes. Still may be the case at one point in time, but it transitioned to the recognition that the more culinary peppers, the jalapeno serrano peppers, were probably the primary vehicle, distributed, produced in relatively small amounts, distributed widely in small amounts, but part of a component of ingredients that made a lot of people ill. And many things came from that outbreak investigation. But within that Food Safety Modernization Act and the Produce Safety Rule, there are exemptions, at least on the books for now, for very small farms that are predominantly selling directly to consumers or farmers market within a certain defined radius. You can sort of read that here. I won't go into the detail. But those exemptions for now are at least planned. The FDA has stated that they will hold until there's a reason to be concerned and remove them. And we've all always maintained, certainly, and tried to help provide education that direct marketers, you know, have some real responsibilities to their customers for food safety as well. And although everybody doesn't have to be, have as elaborate programs as a larger consolidator, you know, everybody should be doing something. And a situation like this that was at least determined to be responsible for a small cluster of illnesses due to E. coli 157-87, I think anyone can look at that slide and say that's probably not the best area to be producing a crop like mixed, you know, mini greens, and, you know, even some corrective actions may not prevent the potential for contamination to occur. More recently, some local fresh grown strawberries were also implicated in outbreak with E. coli 157, 14 ill, and unfortunately one death, and these were all sold at UPIC farm stands and farmers markets. And what complicated the investigation is that the individual operation consolidated strawberries from several farms for their marketing, and as the health agencies came back to that individual operation, they found that the deer droppings genetically matched the case isolates, and there was really high deer pressure in that area, and sort of how all of that happened became very instructive for how one might look at small farm operations. So just taking a step back again, looking broadly at my exposure and experience to outbreak and recall investigations in fresh produce over the last 16 years, I would argue that quite often there was a moment in time for someone to recognize a microbial hazard was present and to make a prevention or control point decision that, you know, could have averted or at least greatly reduced the public risk and consequences to the overall industry and to consumers. And it's really the ability to recognize the microbial hazards as they're developing is a knowledge base and a tool that we have to continually work on to provide support for in training to be able to do that. So very quickly, I, you know, want to just touch on a couple of key areas and then, you know, get to research example and then close out. Water is one of the main areas of focus for microbial food safety concern because wherever that comes in contact with fresh produce, its particular quality can really determine the potential for pathogen contamination and persistence on crop based on its particular characteristics, profile, and the degree of contact with the edible portion that may result. Again, many details here that are involved both in the research and the implementation and practice of food safety management. All I can do is sort of point out probably some of the obvious ones, the way pathogens find their way to either surface water or groundwater, but here focus primarily on surface water as sort of the key area for risk. And of each of the risk factors identified in this cartoon, you know, have been associated with particular contamination events, product recall, or, in fact, outbreaks, whether it's high bird populations, livestock, runoff from compost facilities or stockpile manure, or even irrigation return water or tail water coming back into a common shared irrigation conveyance system, storm runoff from urban centers. All of these things can contribute to the pathogen load of surface water that may be used for irrigation. So, again, the sort of multiple risk factors require the identification and implementation of multiple preventive hurdles. I talked a little bit briefly about worker training, and this cuts across the entire spectrum from field crews to packing, harvesting, and processing. Again, a lot of studies looking at transfer coefficients and transfer rates, and a lot more knowledge about what the potential is. The response has been for at least some of the larger companies. They have very extensive training materials, standard operating procedures, standard sanitary operating protocols and log sheets, etc., in very fat binders. And, you know, some of the more advanced companies, again, just sort of sharing what kinds of things go on, provide a standardized training, issue certification cards, which allows, say, harvest crews to be recognized across different companies because they all have the same need. Compost and soil amendments, at least incompletely composted or non-composted manure stockpiled adjacent to fields are a particular concern Again, in some schemes, they're prohibited from use. Others, they're allowed within certain time frames. If you're interested, you know, there are a variety of resources to get at the particular standards that, exist. And, of course, the concerns are either direct transfer or indirect contamination through other inputs such as water or movement of various vectors or vermin, rodents to birds, and then also the proximity to a field where a, say, perhaps a non-composted manure is being stockpiled or applied while you're in the process of harvesting an adjacent field. Again, all of these things have been shown to be potential hazards of concern. As we move inside to the processing plant, again, not an opportunity to go through details, but just to share with the audience that there's a high potential for cross-contamination and therefore, of course, a high focus on maintaining water quality and a lot of improvements in both water quality management and processes for sort of internal company surveillance of water quality over the last 5 years in particular. I think if you're not familiar with what a fresh cut salad or bag salad plant looks like, it's, you know, highly mechanized, very industrial, and same sorts of good manufacturing practices apply as in any food processing plant, which is some other challenges. Sort of getting to the end of the supply chain, you know, there are recognized risks along the entire chain, but one area that I don't think has had as much emphasis as is needed is in cold chain management and control of temperature. Again, trying to implement these preventive controls for at least growth of bacteria. So then finally, just to close out very quickly, to share just one example of how we address some of the risk assessment, I selected one for the recent study done out in a commercial farm environment, but on it within an experimental field on the survival of human bacterial pathogens on soil crop residues, and then a replant, a very important area dealing with the disposition of a contaminated field, whether it's by flooding or some other event. So here, just to share with you, you know, some of the things that we see, which are pretty typical of researchers doing these kinds of studies. Here we're comparing an attenuated E. coli 157 with a selected surrogate E. coli from that same region, contaminated artificially onto a spinach crop and then subsequently incorporated into the soil as if it was going through a crop destruct phase, a pretty typical thing we see for a couple of years, is a bit of a burst of growth and then a slow decline with a very long survival tail. And the generic E. coli, more environmentally fit than the available attenuated 0157, you know, can be detected at a quantitative level out beyond 100 days. And then a subsequent test, we, you know, eliminated the attenuated E. coli as not being quite as robust as the surrogates that we had developed. I won't go through all of the different treatments because the outcome, you can see, was pretty much the same, but that same sort of burst of growth on the crop residue and then a fairly long survival tail to the point where it got below the limit of quantitative detection, still detectable by enrichment, the same different treatment but with an attenuated salmonella, pretty much the same profile. Salmonella tend to be a bit better. And then after it was below the quantitative level of recovery, but still could be found periodically within the soil by enrichment, planted a crop again, and as you can see here, at two different stages of crop development, both early and then sort of at commercial crop maturity, we were getting, you know, anywhere from 25 to, you know, almost 70% recovery of the applied strains on that crop that was replanted. So, again, what we're trying to do here is provide the data to help establish the standards and policies that the industry would use. So then to wrap up finally here, in summary, I would say that hopefully if you weren't aware already, you know, you're now convinced that, you know, fresh fruits and vegetables, you know, have been associated with significant foodborne illness burden. But, you know, in reality, the illness to total servings per year is staggeringly small. That our next speaker will address that to some degree. And a lot of the contamination events are either directly or indirectly related to human and animal fecal transfer, although that's not the only way. And that really prevention is our best tool in the toolbox throughout the supply chain and really the preferred approach But we can't lose track of the fact that the benefit of consumption of produce, either fresh or further processed, including, you know, canned or other processing steps, really remains a very important consumer message for a healthy diet. And an awful lot still has to be done and remains to retain and earn a greater level of consumer trust, which has really been shaken by some recent events. So really, thank you for your patience and attention. And Romero, I'll turn it back to you.
Thank you, Trevor. Excellent information, and I hope our participants feel the same way I do. We have a few questions, and we have time for a couple of questions before we move on to Dr. Palma's presentation. Question one is, what is your sense of the level of future government control to handle some of the issues you are discussing?
Okay. Well, I guess I will attempt to answer it in this way. I mean, clearly we're moving towards the produce sector becoming part of the regulated community as opposed to operating more under at least federal level guidance and state level guidance. The ability to really control all aspects of the diverse scales of production, the diverse commodities, regions, and et cetera, is a very daunting task, and I'm not confident that there are enough, at least financial resources, to do that. So I think it really is setting the groundwork and continuing that path that the industry itself and all of the stakeholders involved, you know, will take it seriously and be working towards improving and continually evolving both our knowledge and the implementation.
Okay, great. Now, given the seemingly increasing demand for items such as raw milk and direct sales of meat, even at roadside stands or farmers markets, how might good management practices be integrated for these particular products can be integrated into the system?
Let's see. If I understood the question, I think, you know, the expectation for food safety management programs and implementation of preventive controls cuts across, you know, all foods. I just happen to be talking about, you know, produce because that's really the sphere that I work in, but it would apply to, you know, any of those other products, and there are comparable expectations being put in place for them as well.
In Romero's absence here, Trevor, we have another question from the audience. What do you say to a small farmer who refuses to believe in the food safety issues? Is there a way to get them to see the light?
Short answer is no, I don't think so. I think you try and build, you know, a compelling argument for how, you know, these things have to be part of their business plan and their personal liability, and work at that through providing case examples that unfortunately quite often have some very tragic consequences, not just for, of course, the individuals who are ill and impacted in that way and their families, but the industry or commodity group as a whole, the farm workers, the labor, the community that is supported by that agricultural labor. The ripple effect is really staggering. I'm confident that their next speaker will be addressing a lot of that, and one just has to look at the, you know, listeria outbreak on cantaloupe on this past year to just see yet a very, very tragic and dramatic example of what happens. I think ultimately, you know, for somebody that simply believes that denial is their preferred food safety management response, ultimately, I believe the federal agencies will close them down.
Good. One more question here, and then we'll transition over into Marco's presentation. It seems like there's also a consumer education process that might be happening in parallel with the producer education process in terms of how we monitor and manage these things and how the consumer reacts or recovers from these kinds of things. Do you see that easing in the future in terms of the consumer being a little bit more understanding and therefore recovering a little bit faster?
If I understand that, well, maybe I'll do my best to answer it in this way. One, clearly there is a role and a contribution for both food safety awareness and, you know, personal, you know, food safety preventive controls that, that consumers, you know, should be exercising. One of the things we always want to point out is that in general, you know, if something like fresh produce is contaminated, there's in most cases almost nothing really that the home consumer can do to, you know, certainly to remove it or completely protect themselves. And so we can't put it on them to be responsible. But there are certainly handling practices that, you know, can contribute to making the likelihood of exceeding their personal dose response level greater. So, yes, there are education programs for consumers already in place and expanding. There are things that, including my lab, is doing to try and at least say, here are some things that you can do to help protect yourself. I don't know that they will get to a greater level of understanding and acceptance of foodborne illness as a way to minimize the, you know, or accelerate the recovery period for an individual commodity, if that was part of the question.
Thank you, Trevor. Excellent information, and we want to remind participants that these presentations are available in the Ag in Uncertain Times website, so if you need to go back and revisit, that's where you can find them.